Accession number 18802, reel 22.
Brigadier Cowan, reel 22. Your next posting after Malaya was to Army Staff Duties 4, the Ministry of Defence. How much did you know about that post before you went to take it up?
Virtually nothing. I was, in fact, my tour in Malaysia was cut short. I was expecting another year, and I suddenly got a posting to the MOD, to MO4, which I'd been in at an earlier day.
Which would have suited you very well.
Which would have suited me very well. I was going there as a colonel, and it was an outfit I knew something about. I think they'd changed their responsibilities from the time I was there. But MO is always a sort of what you might call a good cachet job to get, and I was delighted. I was sorry to leave the Far East because we, Jennifer and I, were looking forward to a further year there and going to Australia and New Zealand places, and probably Japan as well. Anyway, I got ill just before leaving Malaysia. Jennifer had come home to sort out school and things, and indeed, she was expected to come back to Malaysia because it was all very sudden. And I got glandular fever, whatever that may be, and was quite ill and was very weak when I travelled. Anyway, it was quite clear I wasn't going to take up the MO4 job. And then they kept it open for a month or so for me and then said they're very sorry they couldn't keep it anymore. And so I then, having got well again, reported that I was fit and went to ASD4, which was a novel thought to me. I'd never, although I'd been in SD in the Middle East just after the war, I'd never done it at high level.
Was that a colonel's appointment you took up?
It was a colonel's appointment, yes. It was head of ASD4. And when I got there, it was a very interesting job indeed. Broadly speaking, the organization of the army. There's a two-star committee called the Standing Committee on Army Organization.
Who was on that?
The Director of Army Staff Duties was the chairman, and there were various other sort of two-star people like the Director of Military Operations and so on, and people from the Q side and the A side, the Deputy Adjutant General and so on. And, the Vice Adjutant General. And it was a very high-ranking committee. It really operated on behalf of the Army Board. And, you know, if the Army Board didn't want to get involved in something, they delegated it all to SCO. And my lot, the ASD4, were the secretariat for SCO, which was a very interesting job in itself, quite apart from anything else we were doing.
Did it meet on a regular basis, or did it meet ad hoc?
I don't really remember. I think it was a regular basis plus ad hoc.
So it would have a meeting once every so often to deal with routine, and then
I would think so, yes.
It would be called specially if some urgent matter came up.
That's right. And, of course, the time we're talking about is the time of the rundown of the army by Mr. Healy. I say by Mr. Healy, but I mean at that time when he was Secretary of State. And one of my responsibilities, in fact, was to organise the cap badge rundown, not the manning rundown, but the cap badge rundown of the army. From memory, we were 180,000, 181,000, I think it was, to 152,000, which is a big drop.
Would this then entail selecting units for amalgamation or disbandment?
That was not my responsibility. I was purely on a cap badge basis. The amalgamations, disbandments, the rundown of people was organised on the A side of things, and
yes.
Director Manning and so on. And so obviously we worked very closely together, but you know, I had quite a lot enough on my own plate I was responsible for without taking on other people's responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And so that really was what I was on about for 2 years. And, you know, it was arduous stuff. I mean, there was a lot of Well, there was a lot to do. And then I discovered, it was quite interesting, I discovered that I got involved, of course, in long-term costings and other things as well. And I discovered that there was an equipment program, there was a manpower program, which was my responsibility, there was a long-term costing program, and there were about three or four different programs going on in the Army Department, all of which were using different assumptions. And so I said one day, hey, we ought to have a common set of assumptions. Oh, what a good idea, they said. You better do it. And so I actually was responsible for something called the Army Department Assumptions, which had never happened before. And so I was quite pleased with that and quite proud of it. What happened to them now? I've absolutely no idea.
Do you remember what the significant differences were in assumptions of these particular committees or programs?
No, I don't, actually. I make a bit of a play of saying they were all different. Mm. I mean, they were very similar lines. The language was different. Mm. The timetable was different, for doing these various exercises, and eventually we got everything onto a common timetable, common set of assumptions, which seemed to be a sensible way of conducting business.
Mm. Who was, in theory, in overall charge of these programs or committees?
Well, DASD, the two-star man, was a very powerful man in the ministry. I mean, very powerful indeed. And he really, anything he wanted to force through, he could force through, broadly speaking. And he operated on behalf of the, I'm just trying to think. I think we'd lost a DCGS by that time. I think we were dealing with a VCGS only. But in the old days, when I was first in the War Office before the MOD, there was a vice chief who dealt with the ops and intelligence side, and there was a deputy chief who dealt with the training side, the SD side, and so on. And they were parallel appointments. But in those days, the vice chief, I think, was regarded as the senior of the two. And I think, if I remember correctly, the DCGS disappeared altogether. And we were left with the vice chief. But the DASD, when I was first in the War Office, the DMO was more powerful than the DASD. By the time I went to the MOD, without doubt, the DASD was much more powerful than the DMO.
What does DASD stand for?
Director Army Staff Duties.
Right. These committees, were they then advisory committees or were they primarily executive committees in their functions?
Well, I mean, the only committee as such that I was actually concerned with was SCO, the Standing Committee on Army Organisation.
Ah, so these equipment, manpower and long-term costings, they were programmed
rather
than committees.
They were exercises, they were programmes, yes.
Yeah. So they were being determined by the DAASD, and then they were proceeding along their own lines without being 100% coordinated.
No, the DASD was not responsible for the...
He was not responsible.
He was responsible for SCO.
Yes.
He was the chairman of SCO and reported to the Army Board on SCO and all that. He was a member of a number of other things, but he did not drive through, from memory, the long-term costings.
He didn't.
I forget who was responsible for them. He certainly didn't drive through the Manning things.
Mm. That would be Adjutant General,
which would be the
it?
VAG, who was the equivalent, the two-star equivalent.
Equipment, presumably that would be the Master General, wouldn't it?
There was a VQMG, who was
VQMG,
also the two-star equivalent.
And long-term costings, perhaps the Financial Secretary would be the man.
I think probably, but I don't remember.
You don't remember?
Certainly, the General Staff had a big input into the long-term costings.
Yes.
And I just don't remember who was responsible. But it was an interesting exercise. And the other interesting thing is, and it was something that horrified me when I got to later on into the civil service, how narrow-looking some of the people were who were responsible for various things in the civil service, because I was accustomed to a 5-year plan for long-term costings, and I was accustomed to thinking 5 years ahead, but from a manpower point of view and a money point of view and, a control point of view. And when I left the Army and came into the civil service and found that was not so, I was very surprised.
How far ahead did they look then? Was it just the next financial year? Or
broadly speaking, the next financial year, yes. Mm. Broadly speaking. I mean, I exaggerate a little bit to make the point.
And it's often said that one of the difficulties with coordinating military executive bodies is that the population is floating and unstable because of the two-year posting system, that you come into some kind of staff, you're learning what has to be done and then learning how to do it, and as soon as you become competent, you're handing it on to your successor and you're on your way to something quite different, usually a command post after you've been on a staff. And so it's quite easy for a smallish staff to lose the thread. Do you think there's anything in that?
I can see it's a potential problem, but I think on the whole, I mean, being very immodest, on the whole, I think the caliber of military officers who are going to the sort of jobs we're talking about is so high that they latch on pretty quickly. I mean, it is perfectly true. There's a learning period and there's a handing over period. And in the middle, there's a bit when you really are competent. Mm. Now, it varies, obviously, with individuals. But I think the bit in the middle when you're competent is longer than you might expect it to be. Mm. But it's a real problem, and which obviously speaks for three-year tours rather than two-year tours. Mm. In certain jobs.
Now, you're saying that your main work was concerned with organisation in the army. What were the parameters of that? Were you looking at the army from top to bottom, from the platoon up to the corps and above, or were you looking at a more restricted range, say from division to company or division to battalion? What was your range of vision when you were considering organisation?
That's a very good question, and I'm not sure we actually considered it too much. You see, when I said we were responsible for cap badge, we were really looking at the balance between cap badges, teeth arm on the one hand and logistic setup on the other hand. And we were trying to preserve the balance as it was found. And we were trying at the end of the rundown, and this is, I'm stepping onto A territory now as well as G territory, we were trying to preserve at the end of the rundown a balance of opportunity for promotion, mainly for sort of the officer thing up to commanding officer, but equally for NCOs as well. Trying to preserve a balance so that the opportunities at the end of the rundown were at least as good as when it started, if not better. And that required, of course, a redundancy program to be paid for, et cetera, and all these things had to be argued out with the Treasury. But I think myself that that particular rundown was well conducted and achieved what it set out to do, which was a balanced army at the end of it, which was still of a size that was manageable on the one hand and operational on the other hand. Now, I suspect, and I haven't studied it, but it has nothing to do with me at all, I suspect that the recent rundown, you know, the modern one, went a little bit too far, particularly for infantry. And I think some of that's now been built back in.
There has been an attempt to restore the infantry, but unfortunately they cannot recruit sufficient men to...
Well, that's a separate problem, of course.
It's a separate problem, yes. But I think it's related because...
Oh, I think I've come adrift. Sorry.
I was saying, I think that the difficulties could be related because once an arm has been run down and potential recruits get the idea that it's vulnerable to being reduced for financial or other reasons, then they might well be deterred from joining it.
I entirely agree with that. And, you know, my experience in 1961, when I recruited for the Green Jackets, purely as a regimental recruiter, it bears that out. I mean, we had to work terribly hard to persuade people that the infantry was the right thing to join.
Were you concerned also with career structure? Because another point is that there has, in recent years, been a tendency to recruit men, the expectation that if they're not promoted within 3 years, they will then most likely leave, and that this is a good thing because it keeps the army young and it provides a big reserve. The difficulty of that is that if you've served in one of the teeth arms, the infantry in particular, what do you do for your subsequent career?
Well, I can't answer that question. And we were certainly conscious of future careers. We were certainly conscious of the need for soldiers to be looked after when they came to leave. But in terms of specifics, I can't answer the question.
Was it within your...
No.
It wasn't within your remit at that time. Were there any issues arising from the idea that perhaps there ought to be a major change in the balance between teeth and tail, or in the organisation of fighting formations at the time you were in post?
I don't remember. No, I seem to remember that, you know, over the years, people had looked at balance and had come to the conclusion that broadly it was correct. Obviously, there'd be sort of ups and downs a little bit. I mean, Remy, for instance, would become a bigger outfit than it had been, for obvious reasons.
Consequence of motorisation.
Exactly. And so, I think, subject to that, the broad spread of between arms was reckoned to be about right.
Another question
is... balance between
the arms. Balance, yes, of basically infantry, artillery, armour on the T side.
And engineers. Yes.
Yeah. Something that might affect that is that at this time you mentioned Mr. Healy. He was making a fairly powerful onslaught on the idea of mounting operations east of Suez. And one would assume that if that area of operations was going to be diminished, there would be a relatively smaller demand for light forces and a relatively greater demand for forces equipped for high-intensity combat in Europe. Therefore, one might have expected a greater emphasis on armour and artillery and a reduction in the emphasis upon lightly equipped forces, infantry in particular. Did you notice any of that? Any political input into your considerations?
No, I mean, obviously we knew we were coming out east of Suez, and that was the reason for the rundown, after all, in the first place. No, I think the fact that the British Army of the Rhine and everything that went with it, and the air component in Germany, the supporting side for the army there, I think that it was reckoned that the commitment was whatever it was. And my recollection is it was four divisions in those days, I think, was the commitment to the Rhine Army. I think it was. And that was reckoned to be the most we could afford and would produce a decent-sized balanced force, and that was, you know, our contribution to the Allies. That's my recollection, and that anything else that happened, I suppose because we've always had this worldwide commitment, because we've always hankered after a worldwide commitment, which I believe to be true, despite the fact we were coming out from east of Suez, I think there was always a feeling that we should retain the capability to do things outside the NATO area if we had to.
Well, the argument at the time, as I recall it, was that whilst we would no longer have substantial forces based in the Far East or around the Indian Ocean, we would be able to project them into those areas.
Yes.
And subsidiary issue was how this was to be done, and the balance was shifting against amphibious forces or sea mounted forces towards air portable or airborne forces. Did that have any effect on your deliberations?
I'm sure it must have done, but I absolutely don't remember the detail. I mean, I can't remember, for instance, when there was an organization in recent years called Five Air Portable Brigade. Now, I cannot remember when that came into being, but it must have been somewhere around that time, I would guess.
Well, there was a plan for an entity called the UK Joint Airborne Task Force, which would be a brigade group, which in principle was going to be deliverable and sustainable using aircraft. Aircraft to be based on host nation support in the event of intervention being invited, or on Gan and Mazira, the islands in the Indian Ocean.
Well, I don't recall that particular organisation being brought to my attention.
Do you remember the UK Mobile Force? That was a sea deliverable divisional group, I think.
Yes, I do.
Yes. So that would have impinged on your committee. And
yes, absolutely.
Do you remember what was said about that at the time?
No, I don't, I'm afraid.
But it was something there as an issue.
Something, yes. I'm not sure I'd even call it an issue. I think it was just something to be taken account of. I don't remember it being an issue.
Did this business of reduction provoke lobbying and internal politics?
I don't recall it, no. Surprisingly, I mean, from our point of view, it went very smoothly. Mm. And, you know, talking to my friends on the Manning side, they seemed to think it went pretty smoothly as well. I suppose, first of all, it was starting from a fairly big army. I mean, 181,000 is quite big. 152,000, I think, at the time, we reckoned 150 was about the lowest you could go and still retain the sort of army we all knew and were talking about, is what we thought at that time. Now, how those figures have worked out since, I've no idea, because I think it got down to 130, if I remember correctly, on the present rundown. But no, I don't remember political argument, I don't remember lobbying, I don't remember difficulty, it just seemed to happen. It was quite carefully planned, both from our point of view on the CAPAD side and from the Manning point of view on the redundancy side and the terms offered to people who were not going to stay, which were very, very fair.
Did you have to have any contact with the Navy and Army, the Navy and Air Force during this process?
We got very vaguely involved with Chiefs of Staff business, but it was very much a sideline as far as SD was concerned. That is the difference, I think, between SD and MO. MO does the Chiefs of Staff side. SD does the, let's call it the Army Board side, the SCO side, the organizer, the equipment side, and so on. And so, apart from the fact I seem to remember I had a contact in both the Navy Department and the Air Force Department, and every so often we used to say, how are you getting on, you know. But it was very much our own individual rundown arrangement.
Now, previously, when you were in MO, you'd been in the War Office. Now you're in the MOD. Had there been any significant changes in the way in which business was done or in the atmosphere of the institution in which you were working?
No, I mean, you see, we come back to the fact the title of the thing I was in, ASD, was Army Staff Duties. And so we weren't central staff at all, purely Army, Army Department. And we had a central staff called DS something or other, 5 or 6 or whatever they were, who we talked to every so often and who inquired what we were up to. But they didn't actually direct us. Usually, I mean, occasionally you've got a direction saying you've got to get on and do something or other, which was a central policy issue, which affected all three services. Well, that was fine. But as far as our detailed everyday work was concerned, it was an Army business, an Army Department business. And so to that extent, although I was conscious that the MOD housed all three services, or the headquarters of all three services, it didn't make much difference to my everyday life.
Where were you working?
In the main building.
How big was your staff? Presumably you were the head of the department of ASD.
I was the head of SD4. I had 3 sections, if I remember correctly. To be honest, I can't remember exactly what they were called, but one dealt with the SCO side of business. That was the important section. One dealt with equipment matters and technical matters, and the second one dealt with everything else. So it was an A, B, and C section. And the A section was a major and a captain, from memory. The B section was a major, I think, without a captain. And the C section was a major without a captain. It's roughly that size. And we had a small clerical setup as well, a chief clerk and, you know, two or three other people. So the total size of the organization was 12, 15, something of that sort.
Did you ever meet as a whole staff, or were you all working in your separate sections?
I suppose every so often I probably called them all together and said, hey, what we're going on with now is so-and-so. But otherwise, they worked very much in their individual sections. And if they had a problem, they came to me to sort it out.
Did they work normal office hours, or did they work
They worked regular? Extremely long hours. And, you know, we regarded that as part of the job.
What caused those long hours? Was it just the volume of paper coming into the department?
I think partly volume of work, partly, of course, the political need to get on with this rundown as quickly as possible.
Do you have any idea of the rough balance of time spent on paperwork as opposed to that spent in meetings?
No. I really don't.
Did informal verbal and telephone conversations play a big part in the work, or was it mainly all done on paper in a formal way?
I think it was mainly pretty well structured. You see, as far as the A section is concerned, they were the actual secretaries of SCO.
Keeping the minutes.
Yes, they were doing the minutes, they were doing the agenda, they were doing follow-up papers and so on. So they were largely concentrated on that side and the detail of the rundown. I think the interesting thing about the third section, the C section, is I commissioned them to turn the system by which we were conducting our business from a manual into a computer sort of system, which didn't exist at that particular moment. And fortunately, the man who was in charge of that section, it was exactly his cup of tea to do that sort of thing, whereas it couldn't have been more foreign to me. And, you know, having commissioned him and told him roughly what the requirement was, he then set out to devise a system. And he took, I suppose, about 12, 18 months over it, and tried it out on a number of other departments and so on. And indeed, it was just about coming to fruition when I left. Now, whether it actually has worked or not, I have absolutely no idea, because I've never been back.
This is the early days of computers, wasn't it?
I'm sorry?
This is relatively early in the days
very
of
early,
computers.
Yes, yes.
Did he actually have a budget from which he could purchase computers to use in trials of this?
No, I don't think
system.
He did. He got very involved with the stats people, who were pretty cynical about their whole business, and we were pretty cynical about their business. And so, one way or another, we tickled each other up. And I thought the thing was showing signs. When you say, did he have money to get experimental computers and so on? It was largely, I think, a paper system he was looking at initially, you know, trying to devise something that looked as if it ought to work, and then sort of trying it out, having devised it. But, as I say, it was not really complete by the time I finished.
Presumably he must have had some sort of access to computer equipment if he was going to.
Yes.
Test his...
And I absolutely can't remember where he got it.
So the 2 years you devised the system and began the rundown, was the rundown well advanced by the time you moved on to the next posting? Or were you looking, how far ahead were you looking in ASD4 for completion?